Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Not Just New Movies podcast, the show where we review a seemingly random film currently not in theaters. My name is Ben Pearson, and today we're going to be talking about Sergio Leone's 1968 film Once Upon a Time in the West. Joining me today is my regular co-host, Tyler. How's it going, sir?
Hey, Ben.
Hey, what's going on? All right, so we've also got joining us today is a buddy of mine, Mike Eisenberg, who is a staff writer at ScreenRant.com. Mike, thanks so much for joining us on the Not Just in Movies podcast.
No problem. Happy to be here.
Awesome. All right, so if you guys are just listening in for the first time, we start every episode with the character name game, transition into our media consume section where we talk about what we've been watching, move into our review of the week, and finish with listener voicemails and emails. You can always leave us a voicemail at 904-469-6566 or email us at notjustnewmovies@gmail.com. And you can find this and every other episode of this podcast at notjustnewmovies.com. So Tyler, I believe it is your turn for the character name game this week. What do you have in store for us?
Yes, the character name game for this week is Bruce Baxter.
Bruce Baxter. Awesome.
Bruce Baxter. We have to name the film that character is from.
All right, so we'll come back to it at the very end. I think I might know this.
I think Mike knows. I think Mike knows.
Cool. All right, well, we'll come back to that at the very end. Let's go ahead and move on into the media consume section. This is the part of the show where we talk about what we've been watching, either TV shows, movies, video games we've been playing, any sort of media whatsoever that we've been consuming. So, Tyler, we generally start with you. Let's keep that alive. What have you been consuming?
Keeping it alive. Well, I went and saw the Go-Go's in concert.
Is that real? Is that a real band?
Have you heard of them?
I've never
heard of them. Yeah, the Go-Go's? Yeah. They sing Our Lips Are Sealed, Vacation.
I don't
long story
know.
Short.
I don't know.
Long story short. Damn it, man. How are jokes lined up here? Long story short, somebody woke up with Belinda Carlisle this morning. I'm not saying it was me. I'm just saying someone did. But, see, that was the joke.
Yeah.
So, yeah, they were like an all-girl rock band back in the early 80s. Mm-hmm. That's where they became famous, and I went and saw them in concert, still rocking, still looking pretty good.
I thought that you were saying Long Story Short was another one of their songs, because I'm so totally unfamiliar with them that I just didn't know the difference, that you were trying to make a joke there.
Yeah. No.
Clearly you don't watch enough 80s movies.
Yeah. The other thing I've been consuming, since that was an utter failure, in Astonishing X-Men Gifted, I think I was talking to you about this, Ben. It's on Netflix Instant. Mm-hmm. It's kind of... it's not really a movie. It's not really animated. It's a motion comic.
Okay.
Have you heard of these things? Have you seen these things?
Yeah. Yeah. That's
and,
kind of like,
it's a six part like series, I guess. And it's written by Joss Whedon. And, it's pretty good. It's, if you're getting down from the high of X-Men First Class, I'd suggest checking this out because, it's not very, it's not like the same storyline. It's not a sequel to the movie or anything, but it does have kind of the same dynamics and a lot of the same characters. Wolverine's in it, though. And as far as like the motion comic animation, this was kind of my first full motion comic. I've seen trailers for some, but I don't have a problem with it. I mean, there's a movie that I've never seen, but I got the idea, or I kind of saw the first motion comic, Broken Saints, and yeah, they really did, this X-Men movie did a really good job of taking two-dimensional comic characters and kind of animating them without making it look like a cartoon and making it look like a comic book.
Yeah, it's not like traditional animation. It's just like panels kind of sliding back and forth across the screen, right?
Not so much panels. It's, you take like the characters, the two-dimensional figures from the book and kind of animate them into the world. It looks like a comic book, but it doesn't.
Okay.
You just have to see to get my drift.
I think those are pretty cool.
Yeah, there's a couple other ones on there. There's an Iron Man one, Spider-Woman one.
Mm-hmm.
There's a couple on there that I haven't checked out yet, but X-Men was really good. So if you're if you're coming down from really enjoying X-Men First Class, I'd suggest checking it out.
Have you seen any of those, Mike?
I saw the Watchmen one back when that was out, mm-hmm. and then the Inception one.
Oh yeah, yeah.
Like those are pretty cool. I think they're hard to get used to at first, and they'll probably never be a huge cultural thing. But if you like comics or if it's associated with a movie you like, it's definitely a cool thing. It's much easier to get used to, or much easier to watch than it is to read these days.
Yeah.
And I mean, they're just kind of cool. The music adds a whole different element. It always makes it better, and that's what it does. And I don't know. Some people just don't have access to comics, and it's good they have those on Apple or online or wherever.
Yeah. Cool. And you saw that the X-Men thing on Netflix, Tyler, right?
Yeah, it's on Instant Watch, yeah.
Okay, cool.
X-Men, Astonishing X-Men, Gifted.
Right on.
It's the full title. And then finally, this movie I watched this week was on the Sci-Fi Channel. I DVR'd it. In the Name of the King, a Dungeon Siege tale. For those of you that don't know, Dungeon Siege is a computer game. And this movie, according to the little cable synopsis, starred Jason Statham. So I was like, okay, Jason Statham, this was like a write-off project. It was like him and then a bunch of nobodies. Au contraire, as I was watching it, just more and more people just started popping up. You have Jason Statham, whose name is Farmer. I hope you can guess what he does for a living. Then John Rhys Davies comes out of nowhere. He's a wizard. Ron Perlman comes out of nowhere. He's like fellow farmer. Matthew Lillard's in it. Ray Liotta's the bad guy.
I like how Matthew Lillard gets top billing in your mind over Ray Liotta.
And then the king is Burt Reynolds, which was out of nowhere. So I don't know how much it costs to have all those people in one movie.
Mm-hmm.
But this movie was pretty bad. And it felt like a sci-fi original movie, but it just so happened to have all these really big names in it.
Mm-hmm.
But having said that, I enjoyed it.
Do you enjoy
the Mars Attacks?
I enjoyed almost everything about it.
Okay. Mike, have you seen this movie?
Hell no, but it sounds awesome. Oh, what's that movie with John Travolta where he's got those crazy dreadlocks?
Oh, Battlefield Earth.
Oh, Battlefield Earth.
Yeah, it feels like the Battlefield Earth of Mars Attacks movies.
Nice.
Crazy cast just keep coming and coming. You wonder how the hell did they get these people to do this movie?
Yeah. And it looked a lot like Lord of the Rings. I think they may have like just completely ripped off or rented out the sets from Lord of the Rings. Maybe that's why I enjoyed it. I don't know.
But I mean, Tyler, do you think, what could possibly be your explanation for all these people signing on to this movie? Like, did it have, like, a famous director, or, like, do you think all these people were just, like, closet Dungeon Siege players or something, you know?
You know, there is a famous director, Uwe Boll.
Oh, Uwe Boll. Oh, man. That.
It's all money.
What's that, Mike?
I think it's all it comes down to money, and they're like, "Hey, we'll give you $1 million to do this." Okay, that's at least 100 pounds of cocaine. That'll last me a good couple months. That's probably what I'm guessing Ray Liotta says. But
that's what Ray Liotta said. Yeah,
I mean, he's the B movie king now. He's got straight to DVD movies. Ever since Turbulence, I think he's been the greatest B movie actor on this planet, besides Gary Busey.
Oh man, what a bold statement! I'm sure.
I don't know. I haven't checked out any Van Damme's 2000s films, but I guarantee those are pretty awful.
Yeah, I think Cuba Gooding Jr. might have some words for you, Mike, if he heard that statement from you.
Steven,
don't pick on radio.
Yes. All right, cool. Well, Mike, let's go ahead and move to you. What have you been consuming this week?
Besides Chipotle. Well, one thing I forgot that last night I was watching Face Off.
Nice.
Which is a movie that I think every single person should watch once a month. It's like it's got every single thing a human being could ever want in entertainment. Overacting, slow motion doves, incest. I mean, God, I can't even think of all the things that make Face Off awesome.
Like dragon pistols, right?
Oh, the movie's amazing. The chiclets and the one-liners, just I want to take your face off. I can honestly quote that movie as long as I live and be happy if that's the only thing I saw. But on a serious note, I saw a movie called Midnight in Paris a few days ago and went to it again last night. It stars Owen Wilson, and it's by Woody Allen. It's the least Woody Allen film he's made yet. And I think what's really interesting is that the people I hear him in the movie theater, they don't want to see a Woody Allen movie. And then everybody who leaves that theater at that movie was just completely in love with this movie. Stars Owen Wilson, Marion Cotillard's in it, Rachel McAdams, Allison Pill from Scott Pilgrim.
Oh, yeah.
Tom Hiddleston from Thor, and a couple of other people I can't recall right now, but, I mean, just everything about that movie is awesome, and I don't want to give it away because it actually surprised me the first time, but if you want a movie that's just actually brings you into another world, it's not like some big action movie might do it, but in a really creative way that it's an artsy film that doesn't feel like an artsy film. And it just kind of gives you all those elements that make movies great, like taking you to a world that you could never visit on your own, that you want to be in. It's not the nostalgic movie of 2011. I mean, it is, sorry. Super 8 is not the nostalgic movie of 2011 that everybody calls it. It's actually Midnight in Paris. I highly recommend it.
Cool. So is it more of like a romance or a drama or what?
It's a romance, but it's less of a romance of man and woman as much as a romance of man and city or man and history. And it's really got a lot of romanticism to it without being just a straight-up romantic comedy or anything like that. Like, the characters are real.
Interesting.
And they feel real. But that's Woody Allen's strength, I think.
Yeah, totally. Cool. Yeah, I'll have to check that out because I think it's – is that playing in limited release now or is it in wide release or what? You know?
Yesterday it went wide. Same day as Tree of Life, another movie that hopefully people are willing to see. Two people walked out of that movie yesterday.
Wow.
Two people walked out of Tree of Life, and two old ladies. And as they leave in the hallway, you know, you can still hear them. They're whispering to each other like, "That movie was so terrible. We're going to get our money back. How could you make something like this?" And like the whole theater started laughing and. It was just, how can you not know what you're getting into when you go to a Terrence Malick movie? Do you not expect that? Just went to a movie to see Brad Pitt, maybe?
Yeah, that's probably what happened. I mean, they probably were like, okay, star power, Brad Pitt, Sean Penn, and had no idea what they were walking into. Because Tree of Life, for those of you who don't know, is like, I think it's the fifth movie directed by Terrence Malick in like the past 40 years or something like that. Like, the guy is kind of a, an icon of cinema, basically. Every time like he puts a movie out, it's like a huge event for cinephiles and people who are just like, you know, go crazy about movies. Personally, I'm not that big of a fan of him because I've only seen the Thin Red Line, and I didn't like that movie very much at all. I thought it was like way too heady and just like, you know, too many shots of just nothing that didn't like progress the narrative forward. And then later I'm like, oh, okay, this is not what, you know, I kind of was reading up on him and realized that those aren't the kind of movies that he makes. He doesn't make, you know, straightforward narratives like everybody else does. And that's, like, from what I understand, because I haven't seen Tree of Life, but from what I understand, that's kind of, that holds true for that movie, right, Mike?
I'd say Tree of Life is sort of is all of those ideas in one. It's the most enigmatic movie I've ever seen. It's more confusing, and I don't call it confusing, but it's more of a mystery as a film than The Fountain. To some people, The Fountain is a completely inexplicable movie that makes no sense. I personally disagree. I think if you look closely enough, you can find what the director was trying to do in every movie. And that's really the point with his movies, is he's making the film that he wants to see. I'm not talking about it in the way that like a Uwe Boll does it, or the way that a Lars von Trier makes a movie, where they just are absolutely batshit insane, and they just think everybody else should be. This guy just makes movies that he's moved by, that he writes and feels passionate about, and that passion comes through in the cinematography and the way that it's just put together. And I think that's what makes it a really good movie to me, is that I can feel the director's passion in it. And I don't always know what he's trying to say, but I know that he's trying to say something, and that mystery makes it a really interesting experience because you're trying to figure it out. You're trying to unlock this sort of mental puzzle. And, you know, he doesn't put the pieces right there for you to put together. They're scattered all over the place. And that's really, that's exactly what Tree of Life is. It's the Thin Red Line tenfold. Thin Red Line is pretty straightforward compared to this. In fact, his movies have progressively gotten, you know, a little more mysterious in that word. That's the only word I can use, really. Mm-hmm. I mean, like, briefly, his past, you've got Badlands, you've got Days of Heaven, you've got The Thin Red Line, The New World, and now The Tree of Life. And Badlands is, in my opinion, one of his best movies. It's really pretty amazing. You'd like it. It's not like these mysterious movies, these ones that make no sense. Mm-hmm. It's just a great, awesome little Bonnie and Clyde type movie. But then you get up to The New World. That's just like freaking nature shots. And Christian Bale and Colin Farrell going after the same 16-year-old Algonquin. And now you've got a movie that it's just, if you see Tree of Life, see it for the 20-minute sequence that explores the creation of the universe. It's one of the most astonishing things I've ever seen on screen, ever. And I don't say that a lot. I do dip into like hyperbole all the time. I love this movie. I love that. But there's 20 minutes in Tree of Life that's the most unbelievable 20 minutes I've ever seen. And that includes the likes of Saving Private Ryan's opening scene, you know, or like any tracking shot from Goodfellas.
Yeah.
It's amazing. It's worth the ticket itself.
Okay. All right. Well, yeah, I'm glad that you described it as an experience, because I think that's what they're actually trying to promote the movie as more of an experience than an actual movie per se. Like, they just kind of want you to go in and, like, you know, just kind of be engulfed by all this imagery and try to, like, figure out, you know, where man's place in the world and all that kind of stuff is. They really, like, from what I can gather, are shooting for some, like, super high concept stuff, like trying to take it to a level that hasn't really been reached before. So definitely sounds like an interesting movie, regardless of whether or not it succeeds or fails at any of those particular aspirations. But
yeah,
cool. Anything else you've been watching, Mike?
Not really. Off the top of my head right now, I'll probably think of 100 things when the podcast is over, but
right.
You know, I guess the only other movie that's out right now that I really enjoyed was Super 8, that if you see it in IMAX, you're really seeing it in the best format possible. Mm-hmm. I mean, I'm sure you guys have talked about it before. It's, you know, it's a damn good movie.
Tyler, like, did you get a chance to see Super 8?
I did.
All right, we haven't really talked about it that much. So, I mean, I talked about it on the Geek Tyrant podcast, and people can listen to it over there, you know, like a full-on discussion with us other guys. But let's just talk about it just for a little bit. Tyler, what did you think of Super 8?
I enjoyed it. I thought it was a really good movie. I mean, everybody's saying nostalgia factor. I don't really pick up on that stuff. I just figure, hey, it's placed in the 70s. Although their use of music at that time was too strong. Like, it didn't work. Like, it didn't meld well with what was going on. Like, it was kind of one of those, if like a comedy or a rom-com was set in the 80s or the 70s, like, it's just kind of, oh yeah, let's play this song because it's from the 70s.
What do you mean? You didn't like the use 80s. Of My Sharona?
Yeah, it was just kind of like those songs were in it because that was the decade. Mm-hmm. Like in E.T., you know, it was 1982 or whenever, and everything looks like 1982, but they didn't have, of course, because the movie was current, they didn't have to use music from 1982 to tell the story. But other than that, that was kind of what, like, my one pet peeve about it. But everything else, like, I had a good feeling about it. I did not get bored at any time. No, I didn't get bored at any time.
Okay.
And, I didn't mind the kids acting.
Mm-hmm.
It got a little out of hand.
Yeah, I mean, you and I have established that, like, that we don't really care for kids.
Surprising.
Yeah, you and I have established that we don't really care for kids acting that much, like, in movies in general. But I'm glad that you enjoyed their performances, because I kind of did too, to be honest.
Yeah, so it was all right. I don't know why everyone's kind of making a big deal about the movie, because it's just a good movie. I mean, it's nothing spectacular. It's just an enjoyable film.
All right, well, what'd you think, Mike?
Well, I mean, you might start to think, the problem is we're picking three movies that I love, so it's going to sound like I just like every freaking movie ever made. And then we're going to get into the big classic Western later. But I really liked it because, well, first of all, on the kids note, I thought all these kids were pretty damn good, especially Elle Fanning. But that wasn't really any surprise to somebody who anybody who knows what she's been in before. She's always been good, and so is her sister. It just runs in their blood. But the main kid, Joel Courtney, was just, I don't know, he was surprising to me. He just felt completely real, and I think that's why, is because he was a newbie to acting, and so just being in front of Elle Fanning might have helped him be intimidated by her, you know? Mm-hmm. It wasn't necessarily acting. It could have just been, this is this kid, and he's just being himself. But, you know, it was, I haven't really seen a kid's performance I liked this much since the girl in Brothers.
Mm-hmm.
Remember her name right now, but there are a few and far between. But there every once in a while you get kids that really make a movie better, and I think the script and their performances helped a lot, because this movie wasn't about a monster. It hardly was in it. I mean, it was maybe 10 minutes of the movie had monster stuff in it, and the rest was this kid trying to come into his own and try and become a little bit of a tough guy. Or at least have a little bit of a heart and a soul and step up to the plate.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought that was really interesting. That was a good execution on J.J. Abrams' part. And I got the opportunity to talk to him before the movie came out about it. And he really seemed like he just wanted to make a movie that was about these kids. And he realized it needed more. And he added the monster in later. And I think that made it better, was that it was a story first. And it feels like a story, and it feels like I cared about these characters, and I wanted him to get the girl, and I wanted him to save the girl. And the nostalgia factor is kind of like, everybody keeps bringing up E.T., and I don't understand that. Oh, what, because it's a little kid, and he's got a bicycle, and there's an alien? Whatever, shut up. That's the dumbest comparison I've heard all year.
Well, it's also an Amblin film, I think. That's why everyone's talking about.
But I do think there's a lot of... There are definitely a lot of Spielberg nods, but they're not intentional. They're just like, this is clearly made by a guy who loves Spielberg. Like, if I made a movie, I'm a Chris Nolan nut. I guarantee you, if I made a movie for $35 million or whatever, I'm sure I'd have some Chris Nolan nods in there too. But this is what happens when you've been inspired by a filmmaker who is as iconic as Spielberg.
Yeah, and who also is a producer on your movie.
Yes, and who has that much of an influence on your career and your movie specifically. But, like, if I had to pick a movie, I'd say, like, Super 8 reminded me a lot of Jurassic Park in the way it dealt with the monster. It was always hiding behind bushes, it was rustling leaves, and it was in the shadows, but it was still a powerful force. And it reminded me a lot of the T-Rex with the goat scene mm-hmm. in Jurassic Park. And then, on the other side, you've got, like, also this still. Father character who reminded me a lot of Indiana Jones. He was just kind of charismatic and humorous in a laid-back way. And there were just nods and feelings of older movies that I loved. But it would never... I mean, it was J.J. Abrams' movie. Nostalgia is irrelevant. It's not about that. And I think people are getting distracted by their own memories instead of just getting caught up in the movie that it is, which is good.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree. I liked it a lot. So I want to go into spoilers for Super 8 just for a minute, because I'm interested to hear what you guys have to say about this theory that I have about the movie. So if you guys are listening and you have not had a chance to see Super 8 yet, just skip ahead, go to the show notes and look to when we start talking about the next topic and skip ahead to that point, because I don't want to ruin anything for you guys. So we're officially now in spoilers for Super 8. So when the monster appeared, there's a scene on the bus when like the bus kind of tips over and the guy who's the best friend in the Truman Show, I forget the actor's name right now, but he's like the general or whatever, like the kind of villain of the movie, and he's like trying to shoot the monster in the face, and like its face is being illuminated by these little bullet flares, you know, coming off the gun. And this is like the first look that we really get at the monster's face, at the alien's face or whatever. And I, like, in those little flashes, I was like, holy crap, that looks like the Cloverfield creature. Like, I wonder if this is the same exact thing. And
I talked about that.
Oh, did you?
With my buddies right after the movie, the exact topic. Because, yeah, it looks a lot like that Cloverfield monster, like maybe even if it was a relative of it.
Right.
Seems to me like that's just their thing. That's this sort of... J.J. Abrams and his buddies, they want to make monsters. And I think you brought this up because you're curious if it's connected. And maybe it is. But to me, it's just these guys want to make monsters that we haven't seen before that are huge and disgusting, and you don't even want to look at them because they're so just gross. They're just beasts. Yet there's always one moment, at least in Cloverfield and in Super 8, in which they really sort of romanticize those monsters, even though they're hideous. And you get a really up-close look, and you think, wow, the closer I get, the uglier it gets. And then you get this one moment, like in Super 8, where it opens its eyes and mm-hmm. shows its more human side, kind of, that you really kind of feel for that monster. Even if you don't care for it to live or not, you just know that you're supposed to feel something. And you didn't feel that before because it was just an ugly monster. Yeah, and I think that's what they're going for, personally. I don't know if it's connected, though.
Yeah, Tyler, what do you think? Do you think that it looks similar enough to possibly – because that was my theory. You know,
yeah, I thought the same thing when I saw its legs, the way its legs bent. Mm-hmm. It had that praying mantis anatomy that the Cloverfield monster did. Mm-hmm. But as far as, like, its relation to the Cloverfield monster, like Mike was saying, it's a little too what's the word I'm looking for? It's like it's a little too careful as opposed to the Cloverfield monster, because we actually had an intelligent monster in this one where it had been abused and had learned to hate human beings, as opposed to the Cloverfield monster, which, of course, we don't know much history about. It just came and destroyed everything, yeah. regardless of – and it crash-landed from somewhere. So I don't know if it's a direct link, but I did see similarities. I did kind of think to myself jokingly, oh, it's probably the Cloverfield monster, and it comes back at some point. But I just kind of wrote it off as silly.
I think this creature has like two extra legs, like two more legs than the Cloverfield monster does or something. Like there are some slight differences to the design, but I think because Abrams was a producer on Cloverfield, that those connections, those kind of visual cues between the two creatures right. are done on purpose. Like he would sure. know that this looks like it, and he approved that and said, okay, let's do it anyway. So I don't know if there's any sort of real proof that we can say that these movies are connected, but I think he did it on purpose just so we can have conversations like these, you know?
Oh, yeah. No, there's definitely some continuity between the two films.
Yeah, and it's kind of cool to imagine, you know, like at the very end of Super 8, you know, how the monster just kind of takes off up into the sky, and that's how the movie ends. And then at the very end of Cloverfield, you see in the final, like, shot of the movie, really, like when
you see Vulcan blow up?
Well, no. When the film skips back to the home video footage, and they're looking out over Coney Island, and you see the little egg or whatever fall, satellite or something, fall into the water, you're like, oh, okay, maybe there's some sort of connection there. Because obviously this took place in 1979, Cloverfield years later. So I'm just, that was my theory. Okay, maybe these creatures are like, if not direct relatives, like maybe from the same home planet or something, because I thought those
were Godfather.
Yeah.
I would really like it if that was true. Only if they make one more movie that connects the dots on purpose.
Yeah.
But I, you know what? There are two notes that always spring to my mind when I'm thinking about this. And one is that they had said, of course, that was then, this is now, but they had said with Cloverfield's monster that it was a baby and it was being attacked and it didn't know what to do. And it was just on a rampage trying to escape and destroying everything in its path. But they didn't make that clear in the movie, only in some press interviews. So that kind of defeats the purpose of saying it. But, And that this one was subterranean and that one was trying to live in the water. And those two could be connected pretty well.
Yeah. And I think there's a lot of connection, too, between the way that Super 8, I mean, the title of the freaking movie is about a camera. And, like, that was a really huge part of Cloverfield, too, is, like, this visceral, like, we have to capture what's going on now. This is important to preserve this. And, like, Abrams in particular has these themes that run through both of these movies that are like, okay, it's like the importance of cinema, the importance of filming and the act of filming and the act of recording things for posterity. And like, you know, the camera in Super 8 tips over and it's like it's their first real look at the monster before anybody else gets a real look at it aside from the military people. So I think, you know, Mike, you're talking about, I hope they make another movie. There could be one where they throw it into the 80s or 90s or something and do like a mid, you know, a bridging the gap type of movie that also deals with cameras and you know, like keeping those where it would be like a spiritual sequel, like a series that's kind of connected by these overarching themes, as opposed to like maybe any sort of more concrete connections other than just the creature and where it's from or something. So it would be interesting to see them do it.
One fun note, in addition to the title, anybody who hasn't seen it yet or wants to see it again, there are 8 main characters, and J.J. Abrams mentioned in an interview that it also correlates to the characters, that there's these 8 super people that are experiencing this all together, which I thought was pretty interesting.
Oh, okay.
I didn't think that was an accident.
Yeah, I didn't even think about that. Nice.
I don't know if it deserves, I don't want to say that, but I don't think it needs a sequel. I think it's, again, like E.T., where everything is completed and everyone learns something in one movie.
Yeah.
Not going to be enough to green the sequel anyway, which is the good thing, I think.
Yeah.
Seems like it's just a favor.
Or maybe we already have a sequel, Cloverfield.
Indeed. All right, well, the one thing that I wanted to talk about was a movie called Superman 3, and I just watched this morning for the first time.
So sweet.
Have you guys seen Superman 3?
Hell yeah.
Okay, Mike, you have?
Richard Pryor, right?
I haven't seen it in a while, but I've seen it.
Yes, Tyler, Richard Pryor's in it. It is, and I'm going to have to check myself here and kind of go down the list, but I'm going to go out right now and say that it's one of the worst superhero movies I've ever seen. I know that I would rather watch Elektra than watch this again, so that's just giving people a little bit of a barometer for my feelings on Superman 3. Guys, this movie is so awful. Richard Lester comes back to direct it, who, if you know anything about the Superman movies and the Richard Donner cut and the whole differences between that stuff, which actually Tyler wrote a review for Superman 2, the Richard Donner cut, back on Not Just New Movies a long time ago. So you can check out notjustnewmovies.com and search the archives for that. And he mentions a little bit of that history there. But Lester was the one who kind of replaced Richard Donner on Superman 2, and then he came back for Superman 3, and this movie is just god awful. Like, they threw Richard Pryor in there just to be topical. What's her name? Margot Kidder, who plays Lois Lane, did not get along with Richard Lester because she didn't appreciate the way that Dick Donner was treated. And basically, so what they had to do was make Clark go back to Smallville and just have Lois show up in the first 5 minutes of the movie and then just say, oh, I'm going to Bermuda.
Oh, yeah.
And then she leaves and then doesn't come back until like the last 2 minutes of the film. So she's like barely in it. That's why Lana Lang shows up, which is interesting.
You know who plays Lana Lang, right?
Yeah. Interestingly enough, is played by Onette O'Toole, who comes back in Smallville, the TV series, to play Martha Kent. So that was kind of a cool connection there. But this movie, guys, like, it's, I can't even explain to you how god awful it is. Like, there's so much slapstick humor that's not like what the Superman movies should be. There, at one point, the villain, like Lex Luthor, is nowhere to be found, which is kind of a disaster. These other guys who come in, like Richard Pryor, basically is unemployed at the beginning of the movie. He sees a matchstick that, or a matchbook that says, make money fast, become a computer programmer. And he goes to sign up for work and just magically becomes a computer programmer. Like, he's a genius at it, which is never explained. He comes up with this concept to siphon off all of the half cents on the paychecks of this multinational corporation and funnel them into his own account, which is, you know,
which is brilliant.
That has come up in countless TV shows and movies. I mean, Office Space, like, probably most prevalently, I guess. And it's just like nothing makes any sense. And Richard Pryor, like, kind of toes the line between being a good guy and a bad guy. Like, he's really greedy. He goes out and buys like a Lamborghini with all this money that he illegally makes, and then he like kind of tries to save Superman at the end, but not really. And then Superman gives him a job at the end, and then he doesn't take it. He just walks away, and it's just like there's no consistency to the characters whatsoever.
Now, is this the one with the radioactive man?
No, that is
that's Superman 4.
Or The Quest for Peace, which I have yet to see, but I'm getting ready to, and I'm probably going to talk about that one, I don't know,
that one
next week or something.
Really bad. That one's really bad. But does this one have Bizarro or, like, evil Superman?
Yes, yeah.
Fights him in the garbage in the landfill or the junkyard?
If you want to see an awful scene, then YouTube that. because it's pretty bad. Like, Richard Pryor creates kryptonite, but doesn't know, like, there's 1% of the element that he doesn't know what it is, so he replaces it with, like, tar from cigarettes or something, and that somehow turns into red kryptonite, which makes him, like, evil and apathetic, and, like, he's just kind of a... Superman is just kind of a douche, and he gets drunk in one scene. Like, there's so many things about this movie that are just awful and not in character with... not in kind with the Superman movies that have come before, so...
And I'm pretty sure the fight between Superman and bad Superman isn't real. Like, I think it's all in his head, because I don't think... sure not two Supermans fight.
Well,
although
it's weird, because I think it is real, because it shows him, like, crash landing in this junkyard and, like, gripping his hair and just screaming to the heavens, and then Clark Kent, in a full-body suit and glasses, walks out of his body... and then begins to battle him, and then at the end of the fight, spoiler alert for the garbage dump fight scene, he chokes the evil Superman into oblivion, and he just disappears. Right. So, like, there's only one remaining, and then the new Clark that just, you know, kind of came out of this old body rips off his shirt, and now he's wearing the Superman costume again. So it's just like, there's so many things. Yeah. The worst... part of the whole movie, I think, for me, was the villains in this movie, which are awful, create this, like, underground computer base in the Grand Canyon.
Oh, that place is sweet.
And they're down there, and they've got these control systems on this computer, and it's a screen, and they've got missiles, just, I have no idea how, but they've got these turrets that are just placed along the Grand Canyon full of missiles. And they're playing, like, a Superman video game where he appears on this screen and they try to shoot him with a little crosshairs as if it's, like, a game that they're playing in Aladdin's castle or something, you know, like some sort of arcade. And it just...
No one gets that reference.
It's not even Superman on video. It's a computerized version of what Superman would have looked like in a video game in 1983 when this movie came out. And it's like, who programmed that into the computer? How do you know what he's doing? Who is doing this? Oh god, it's so bad. So all right, I'm gonna stop.
So check out Superman 3 is what you're saying?
I'm saying never ever watch it if you're a fan of Superman, because it's really disappointing. So
I'll check it out for a good laugh, I guess.
Oh god, yeah. If you wanna laugh at how much time you wasted in a day, then check it out.
I own it.
But
wait, do I own it? Yeah, I do. Oh yeah.
All right. Well, let's go ahead and move on into our main review of Once Upon a Time in the West.
The railroad. The boom towns. A new life. And the promised land. Once upon a time.
Marie!
The widow. The land grabber. The outlaw. The gunman. The man in search of a name.
All right, so Once Upon a Time in the West is a movie that came out in 1968. It is a spaghetti western directed by Sergio Leone. This came after the Dollars trilogy of...
Man with No Name trilogy.
Yes, exactly. So, Mike, I brought you onto this episode because I know that you're a big fan of this movie, so let's go to you. What do you think in general? Let's just do some kind of opening thoughts, and we'll dig a little bit deeper. What did you think about Once Upon a Time in the West?
Well, the first thought is that great directors like Quentin Tarantino, somebody who some people might not think is a great director, but I love him, would not exist without movies like this. And I say that because Sergio Leone and... like, his love of movies really shines through in this, and those nods that he makes to classic westerns that came before him really kind of all come together in a way that make this movie its own great western with its own great moments and great characters. And Charles Bronson, I mean, the characters he's played in his career are just so memorable, but none more so than this. And Henry Fonda's career is illustrious as any, and yet, to me, this is his best role because he finally departed from his normal like nice guy.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, and then Claudia Cardinale's beautiful face.
Ooh.
And then Ennio Morricone's score is one of the greatest I've ever heard. I mean, every aspect of this film is perfect, and couple that all with the cinematography, and it's almost the perfect movie. If it, you know, it's paced in a way that really puts everybody in a corner, makes you want to not believe that this is a great movie, because it really doesn't stay its course at times. It's got three different stories, all connected, but they each get their own time in the shot, in the limelight, and it makes you pay so it makes you pay attention for such a long period of time that you either get lost in it or you get lost out of it. And if you lose your track just once, it's like a freaking calculus class in high school. Done. You know, you have to pay such close attention to really get the full feel of this movie that you'll realize that it's about as close to perfect as any movie before, you know, 1994.
That's a seemingly random date there.
I think 1994 is the greatest year in movie history.
Wow.
Look,
is that the year The Shadow came out and Ace Ventura?
Yes. Ace Ventura is the only movie I was referring to.
Awesome. All right. Well, Tyler, what do you think?
Ben, I was one of the people that Mike mentioned that lost their way in this movie. I really liked it because it did feel like the spaghetti westerns of old, the Man with No Name trilogy, but it was god-awful boring, and it took me a long time to get through it, obviously, because it's almost 3 hours long, but it was just really slow-paced, and, I mean, the music was really good. I really did like the score, although I don't know if it was my speakers or there were a lot of like really annoying sound effects at the very beginning, and they didn't establish a lot in the first like hour or the first half hour, 45 minutes. And so, but by the end, once I had situated myself, I think I ended up liking it, but I really dug its Western themes. I just didn't really dig the time it took for me to get through it.
Yeah. I can see that. I mean, a lot of times, you know, like, yeah, this movie is freaking long. It's like, I don't know what version you guys watch, but I have like a special edition DVD, and it's like, it was like 2 hours and 45 minutes or 50 minutes or something like that. And I know that when it aired, or when it aired, when it hit theaters originally, they had to cut out a bunch of stuff because Time Magazine put like tedium in the tumbleweed or something for the title of like a review of this movie or something, saying that like, you know, American audiences just couldn't handle it because it was so long and drawn out and stuff. But I'm kind of with Mike on this one. I really, really love this movie. I think it's, you know, I just saw it for the first time yesterday, so it's going to take a little while to sink in, but it's probably going to end up being one of my favorite Westerns ever made. I think it's just like all the editing it does take a long time, but it's so great at building tension. And that's what kind of Leone really contributed, I think, to the Western genre is, you know, those famous showdowns in The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly and all those other movies. They come back here and he does it, you know, the same way, and it's perfect. Like there's a scene at the very end of the movie where Harmonica and Henry Fonda's character,
Frank
they come face to face in this kind of, you know, epic showdown or whatever. And they're like, you know, they slowly like walk to their different corners, getting ready to, you know, kind of draw iron or whatever the phrase is on that. And like then Charles Bronson character, he just walks really, really close to Frank. And then the camera just stops and stays there. And you're just mesmerized, like waiting for something to happen. And then it cuts away and you're like, okay, like a momentary breath. Leone just does such a good job in the editing room, I think, of being able to like just keep us on our toes and make like force us, like Mike was saying, to pay attention to all these things because of the way that the music comes together and the way that the movie is shot, and just the editing, I think, is more important here than in a lot of movies that we see today. Like he really uses that as kind of an art form, as opposed to today, where it just sometimes it just feels as like, you know, people are just doing it as like a necessity instead of really kind of loving the art of editing. But yeah, I don't know. Any thoughts on that, anyone?
I agree, especially with I want to focus on your comment about it potentially being one of your favorite Westerns. And I think what makes it so strong is its ability to recognize the strengths and weaknesses of the Westerns that came before it, specifically ones that it references directly, like High Noon, that opening scene in Once Upon a Time in the West is almost a direct nod to High Noon and the railroad scene in that movie. Yet in Once Upon a Time in the West, he finds a way to focus on the subtleties of waiting for a train that nobody has ever done, nobody probably has the balls to do, because it is tough. I mean, you're asking the audience of a lot to literally, in the opening scenes, to sit there. I mean, if you thought the opening scene to There Will Be Blood was boring, no dialogue, you know, hardly any noise, just observing this environment was boring, you are going to fall asleep within the first 20 minutes of Once Upon a Time in the West, because it is literally, we are sitting there waiting for a train with three people who don't talk, and there's this exaggerated sound effect, sound design. Mm-hmm. It's really pumped up in post-production, and all it does is make you want something to happen. And then when it does happen, everything that you know about Westerns is flipped upside down. All that huge action that comes with the showdown, which is really just a matter of two people pulling a trigger that happens in the span of 1 second. What I love about this movie specifically is his ability to shine the spotlight on everything around the violence and let the violence only take 2 seconds within the span of a 20-minute scene leading up to that specific shooting.
Yeah,
I just think that's the greatest accomplishment of this film is all this subtle, peaceful, quiet energy that leads up to one moment that the sound is pumped up to such a level that makes it, you know, it's absolutely absurd. It gets right in your face, and you forget that your volume is turned up 95% of the way, and it just blasts you in the face. It's great.
Yeah. So, Tyler, you weren't a fan of that opening sequence in particular, like the sound design and stuff?
No, it really irritated me. That, the windmill squeaking, and then the scene with at Sweetwater with like the buzzing bugs that kept going and coming because there were people approaching.
Yep.
Like, yeah, the sound effects, like the environmental sound effects, like Mike said, were like amped up in editing so that you really, like, that was the most dominant sound, and it was kind of, because usually, again, they're environmental sounds or natural sounds, and you kind of, you're biologically, you've put them to rest as far as sounds right in your ears, but this movie kind of highlights them, and kind of, especially if there's no dialogue and nothing's really happening yet, it kind of gets on your nerves. But like I said, it was the first 30, 45 minutes that kind of had me, biting at the bit, if you want to make a horse reference.
Yeah. I agree with you to an extent it becomes really annoying. Yeah. I guess I for some reason like it in this movie, but the way that, one thing that I don't like, but I respect because it's an old movie, is the ADR or at least the syncing of the dialogue. It's so brutal.
Yeah.
And I guess I love that about this movie for some reason. There's something about it that makes it feel real, like a real movie that somebody made. And, like some of the words they say when he yells Marie, right when the girl gets shot near the beginning of the movie, it's so off and it's laughable, but yeah, it makes it feel like a real spaghetti Western.
Yeah, and yeah. I mean, it was a real spaghetti western. They filmed it, you know, in America to some degree, in like the Monument Valley where John Ford made all those great, you know, the Searchers and all that kind of stuff. And like Leone really wanted. I was watching the behind the scenes stuff, so this is like me kind of reciting some of the stuff that I learned on the behind the scenes documentaries. This is not me being like a western historian or anything. I'm not trying to pass this off like I'm a badass and I know exactly what, you know, I've known this for a long time. But they were saying that like Leone wanted to capture the same visuals that he had grown up with, you know, watching John Ford's movies and stuff. And he wanted to incorporate that into this movie, as well as, excuse me, shoot a lot of it over in Spain and stuff like that. So yeah, he does a great job of bringing all that stuff together. And, yeah, I think the movie's much better off for it.
The Searchers is my favorite Western. So maybe that's why, since it's kind of different from the Searchers, maybe that's why I didn't really attach myself to it.
Yeah, and I think, like, you know, that's what Mike was talking about earlier. The way that this movie, like, takes Western conventions and kind of flips them around is really brilliant, I think. Like, you have Henry Fonda, who played, you know, young Mr. Lincoln and all these, like, throughout his career, he's got all these really, really, you know, pure characters. He was, like, the good guy, like, the tradition. He's like a Tom Hanks, you know, today type of guy. And to have him be the villain in this movie was like a really inspired bit of casting. I mean, it's just kind of reminiscent of, like, I don't know, Denzel Washington in Training Day or something, you know, like just something that kind of takes the audience by surprise. I was like on that same bonus disc or whatever, there was an interview with Henry Fonda that was done in, I don't know, like the mid-70s or something. And he was saying that when he got the part, he read the script and was like, oh, this is really cool. And he like tried to grow out facial hair and like he got all these contacts to get rid of his blue eyes and stuff and like tried to scruff himself up and look like a badass. And then as soon as he showed up on set, Leone was like, no, get rid of that. Go back to the way that you normally look because that's what I want. And he said there's this one scene that's like the introduction of Frank and it's like right after the family gets killed and it gets gunned down in the very opening part of the movie. And the camera spins around slowly and reveals that Frank is Henry Fonda. And he's like, that's what Leone wanted. He wanted people to be like, holy shit, that's Henry Fonda. Like, so that's the kind of that's the kind of approach that Leone had to this movie, was taking, you know, what you expected from these other Westerns and giving you that to some degree, but also, you know, putting his own little spin on things. So, you know, also like the whole plot of the movie, you know, like about it being about land and stuff, which is such a classic like Western trope. You know, you see that in all the, it's either about land or water or both. Those are like the main things that all Westerns, all good Westerns are about, really. Even like Rango, which just came out earlier this year, was kind of a you know, takeoff of some of those old Westerns and stuff. And that also involved it. But, you know, even that, like, to some degree has a little bit of its own spin thrown on there with the guy buying up all the land beforehand and, like, you know, having this forethought and foresight to try to build this station as the train is coming through and everybody battling over land that doesn't really mean anything yet, but it will be eventually. And, yeah, I don't know. I really, really enjoyed this movie, so.
I have to say that as far as movies that reveal, that have like a reveal or some kind of a plot twist or whatever, this is way up there for me. Way up there near the top of movies that have a huge plot twist. That final moment that you were referring to earlier about the showdown between Frank and Harmonica,
mm-hmm.
The reveal in that scene is so awesome. I mean, that makes every one of those moments where you're kind of like, am I bored right now? I think I'm bored. It makes every single one of those moments worth it and makes me realize that if this was a 90-minute movie, it wouldn't have hit me as hard as it did because it just draws you in and continues to do so until either you turn the TV off or you turn it up. And I think that's the power of this movie, and that twist and the connection of that theme, the motif, the sound of the harmonica is just so well executed. And, you know, I think that has a huge – Ennio Morricone has a huge stake in all of that. He – one of the common pieces of knowledge with this is that he made the score before the movie was shot.
Mm-hmm.
He worked with Sergio Leone on that score before it was shot. And I think that just – like, that's mind-blowing to me. As somebody – as a filmmaker, you know, I haven't made a feature or anything. I've made some short films, but – I still consider myself one, and it just blows my mind that that's even possible. I'm doing a test. I'm trying to actually do that right now and like experience that process of going music first and creating something to that music. Mm-hmm. It's really just bizarre. And to do that with a feature film in which music is so important to the pacing of your movie is crazy. And to do it back then in the mid-1960s when they don't have the technology to sort of just like sync it up and listen to headphones or something while you're, you know, on set.
Yeah.
It's mind-blowing.
Yeah, I'm totally with you on that. I think, you know, reveal-wise, Tyler, what did you think about the, you know, the harmonica origin story, if you will, that was revealed in that final showdown?
Well, actually, I went back and there were a couple parts I didn't understand. So I went back and rewatched them, and they all made sense after I'd seen the ending.
Mm-hmm.
So where he was, like, dropping different names whenever anybody asked who what harmonica's name was, he always gave a different name, and each one struck Henry Fonda in a different way, and he's like, that's not your name,
right?
And I thought that was really cool when I went back and rewatched it. But the harmonica origins, yeah, it definitely gave that character his final goal, which up until that point the character or the audience really had no idea why harmonica was doing all this stuff and turning in Cheyenne for $5,000 and helping out the widow and all this stuff. But then you eventually realize it's that aha moment, just like Mike said, where you're just kind of like, oh, okay, so that's why for the last 2 weeks he's been there in Sweetwater.
Yeah, and I think that's something.
Can we reveal what the twist is?
Yeah, go for it. Yeah, we can go ahead and spoil anything we want.
Henry Fonda's character, Frank, killed, I guess, what was it, Harmonica's brother?
Yeah.
But Harmonica was holding him up as he was being hung. So, like, Harmonica, the person, was the stool that would have been kicked out from under his brother to hang him. And then, so Henry Fonda says, give my love to your brother or something, and puts the harmonica in Harmonica's mouth. And so, like, the strain of holding his brother up causes him to breathe through the harmonica, which, of course, gives that haunting music that we hear throughout the film, and then we realize why he's after Frank.
Yeah, I think
and then the bells, of course, represent his brother hanging because he was hung from a bell, I think.
Yeah, I think the way that you know, even in Leone's other movies, like the Dollars trilogy, you know, it's never really Clint Eastwood's character, the man with no name. His backstory is never really, if I'm remembering this correctly, he's never really gone back and explained or any sort of reasoning for what he's doing. He's just kind of this wandering drifter that kind of rolls through these different towns. And, you know, he's motivated by – what's that?
He's a force of nature.
Yeah, he's exactly.
Retribution.
Yeah, and he's motivated by money to some degree, but he's also got this code of honor and stuff. But it's never really shown why he does what he does. And that's just yet another way that Leone is able to kind of circumvent these conventions, some of which he actually set up himself in those movies by showing us in Once Upon a Time in the West why Harmonica does what he does. You know, if this movie were made today, they would make an entirely separate prequel about Harmonica, I feel like. But back then, that whole concept was just completely foreign to people, so they wrapped it all up in one movie, which I really appreciated. I thought that was great. I thought, you know, the way that reveal is kind of revealed to the audience was great. I thought it was perfect.
You're exactly right, though. They would have made a different movie. And I thought about that last night. I wanted to mention that today, was that you could vouch for 3 hour-and-a-half long movies as opposed to 1 3-hour movie, and it would work just as well. Maybe even more universally accepted and like loved by more people if it was that too, I think. And I hope they never do it, but I would be interested in that kind of a remake or reboot of this concept. And this, I don't think anybody could ever do it as well as they did it there. They shouldn't even do it.
Yeah,
but I would support it if Hollywood just ultimately did, because I find those stories to be compelling in their own right. You know, they don't necessarily need these characters. They've been done before. Hell, Kill Bill, it has a lot of this element to it anyway.
Yeah.
You know, Left 4 Dead, comeback revenge. It's not an uncommon plot in a movie, but it's just executed so well and done so well in this movie that if you spread it out to three movies, hour and a half long, each character gets their own movie, and ultimately they have some kind of showdown as they do in this movie, it would have worked. I think it would have worked, and that just goes to show you how well thought out the characters are themselves.
Yeah. I don't know. I would say that I'm like you're saying, the other movies could probably have the same story. I don't know if a definite remake is in order. Like you said, they did it really well in this one, and I think for cinematical protection and preservance, I would keep it the way it is, but maybe tell the story again in another Western. That'd be great. It doesn't have to be another Once Upon a Time in the West, but it could be something with the same storyline. Like The Searchers. The Searchers was redone in that Tommy Lee Jones movie. I'm blanking on it now.
Was it the three burials of whatever? Or was it The Missing, maybe?
Yeah, it was The Missing. The Missing was kind of a remake of The Searchers, but it wasn't like a direct remake. There wasn't the John Wayne character and the different characters, but it was kind of the same story.
Mm-hmm.
And then the other thing about why is it so long? Well, if we look back at Lawrence of Arabia, which was, 1962?
I think so.
Like that was the movies. They were just really, we don't have movies. I mean, we have movies coming out all the time now, but I think back then it was like the one big movie of the week or of the month or of the year that everyone, would try to go see. And that was the day, or that was the afternoon, or that was the evening. You would go and see this epic Western or this epic adventure, if you're talking about Lawrence of Arabia.
Mm-hmm.
And, it did and now that I'm thinking about it, I'm going back to what I said about Lawrence of Arabia, which I also thought was really boring, but then realized it was boring for a reason because, they're trying to tell the life and the story of these characters, and you really can't do it in like an hour and a half.
Yeah.
It has to be 3 hours because then you get a feel for the characters and then you mourn when some of them die or you're happy when they succeed or whatever.
Yeah, exactly. So,
it was just the 60s, I guess. 50s, 60s.
Yeah. One nitpick that I want to bring up, and I don't know if you guys have an answer for this, but why wouldn't Frank have recognized Harmonica if he was the one who gave him the harmonica? That was the only thing that didn't really sit well with me was like, and this, it's a tiny thing in the grand scheme of this movie, but like, it shows that reveal that we talked about where he puts the harmonica physically in his mouth and then walks away and just kind of, laughs this evil laugh or whatever. And then like, he comes across him years later and it's like, how many kids did he do that same exact thing to where if you hear the harmonica and like figure out, okay, this is like a drifting gunslinger who has a grudge, like, who have I harmed in my past in a specific way related to harmonicas? Like, how many people in his Rolodex does he have to flip through to be like, it could be one of 50 different people, Like, I just found it strange that he wouldn't be like, oh, yeah, you're probably that one kid that I did that to.
Well, yeah. I think it's got something to do with this is his career. This is his job. He does this all the freaking time.
Yeah.
He does creative things to mess with people and he kills them, but he doesn't I killed your brother 20 years ago. I don't remember your ass.
Yeah.
No remorse.
Yeah. He's like, oh, I've killed some people today. And he goes home to his wife and he's like, yeah, I killed some more people today. She's like, what'd you do this time? I don't remember. Where's the steak?
Yeah.
The next day he wakes up and he's like, who do I kill today?
Yeah.
But you're right in the sense that because we get so connected to the characters, we wonder, like, why don't you just know that theme, that song right there is how you killed somebody?
Yeah. I just thought that was such a specific way of treating someone that probably would have stuck out even in like a laundry list of murders that Frank has surely committed throughout his life. But
you're definitely right, though. It's an excuse. My answer is literally the excuse.
Yeah.
I like the idea that he does the harmonica thing to everybody he kills. So he can't remember because he's constantly having to buy new more harmonicas.
Yeah. Have you guys, either one of you played the game Red Dead Redemption?
Oh, yeah.
Tyler,
multiplayer. I rocked that game in multiplayer.
Okay. The scenery in that movie, or in that game, I think, was inspired by this movie. There's a lot of stuff where characters are like riding around on horseback and like on carriages and stuff, where I was like, wow, this looks just like Red Dead Redemption. So I just wanted to bring that up.
I'm looking at a dead man.
I just wanted to bring that up as kind of a corollary, I guess, but I thought that was kind of a cool thing. Basically, that's just giving props to the team behind Red Dead Redemption for kind of doing their homework, but they did a good job of kind of making, I mean, both of those landscapes in the game and in the movie are just like stunningly gorgeous. So that's what Leone also does really well, is have these, you know, really big kind of widescreen cinematography and stuff that really just fills up the frame. And also, speaking of that, talking about those documentaries that I was watching about it, like the behind the scenes stuff, people were saying that one of the really big things that Leone also did was used people's faces as a landscape too. Like, he, you know, those close ups and stuff that he gets, and you get really like right in there with Bronson's face and Fonda's face and all these guys who have this kind of craggly, broken skin and stuff. And that, like, just as much as Monument Valley and all these other places, is a landscape for the viewer to kind of get a vibe for that time and that place and all that kind of stuff. So I thought that was kind of a cool point that somebody made on those behind the scenes things too. But
isn't that what's just great about the spaghetti Western genre, is that, you know, classic Westerns, they always had these like Hollywood hunks who were just perfect faces, and they had enough that, you know, they got their close-ups and they were well lit. And now you've got all these characters like the Clint Eastwoods and the Charles Bronsons. They just have these dirty, wrinkly, you know, scraggly faces that they feel, you know, they've been through a lot. Even though these actors bring with them everything they've done beforehand, these characters have their own look, totally different from the classics, like, all of them.
Yeah. Yeah. Even, even some of John Wayne's like early stuff, you know, that's the kind of, he's very clearly the white hat hero, you know? And he's lit that way and all that stuff too. So yeah, you're exactly right.
Like, look at True Grit is a good example of a modern movie that has as closest to the look of a spaghetti Western as we've had recently, especially in the characters, like, you know,
Bridges.
Thank you. Jeff Bridges and Josh Brolin are two people who have leading man faces, but they're both kind of scraggly enough to really work in that time. And, you know, even a guy like Kyle Chandler might have that look too if we gave him a chance. I've always kind of wanted to see him in a Western.
Interesting. One thing we haven't really brought up, with the exception of Mike in the very, very beginning, was Claudia Cardinale, right? Is that how you say her name?
I think. Oh, yeah.
Tyler, what did you think about, you know, just her as a character and also, like, her specific acting? Because I don't think I've ever seen her in anything before.
I really liked her acting. Jill, the whore from New Orleans, I believe, was her full character name.
Yep.
I really liked her. Not only was she, you know, of course, easy on the eyes, but she played the strong widow of this guy that, I guess, from what I could tell, she only knew maybe a couple months. And, you know, she came expecting a family and they're all dead, and she has to, like, handle the affairs of keeping this house and trying to sell it, but then realizing, you know, what it's worth and all this stuff. I don't think she's as involved as she could have been, but as involved as she was, you know, I thought she did, you know, as well a job as Fonda and Harmonica and Cheyenne. They were the four main characters, and I thought she held her own among the three men.
Yeah.
Mike, what do you think? Both of you, do you think that she was telling the truth or lying when she said that they were married a month before she arrived?
You know, I was wondering about that, and I was also wondering, like, if she was even, like, if her story was even real, like, if she was just kind of a con, you know, like, a not a con man, but a con woman, you know, like, if she was just there, because she didn't really break down and grieve over the death of this family, and I guess it's because she didn't really know them. But one of the first things she does is just goes and, like, starts rifling through all the belongings looking for, what, gold or something, right? I think they reference that there's
She thought he was rich.
Yeah, exactly. So, like, I'm wondering if it was, if her relationship was genuine at all, or if she had just done it just for the money. And then if she had done it just for the money, then that makes her character kind of even more interesting, I think, that she does stick around and doesn't just immediately move on to the next thing, you know? Like, she tries to make something out of this particular scenario, even though seemingly she's hit a dead end or something. So I don't know. What do you guys think?
That's definitely the point. It's got to be. I mean, it has to be that this girl was just kind of a chick that he picked up and wanted to marry just because that's his style. He came back home. She came back a little later. The whole time they were apart, she was thinking, I'm going to get all this money when the train comes through. And then she realized that when he was killed, she just kind of grew up and she thought, there's responsibility for me here, and I have a reason to be here, and I need to honor this family.
Yeah.
She did that, and I think that's very heroic of her character, but it's also up in the air. You're right. It could be either.
Yeah. What do you think, Tyler?
What if she was lying about whether they got married?
Yeah.
Nah, I don't think she was. I mean, the entire movie, I didn't get the feeling that she was dishonest in any way, so I don't think she was lying.
Yeah.
That's just based on, as a whole, the character in the movie.
Right.
I mean, just because she was a lady of the night in New Orleans, you know, doesn't mean she was evil or, you know. I mean, obviously she did want a lot of money.
Yeah.
I mean, that was clear from the starting point, but she wanted money to get out of that town and get out of that business so that she could – she even says, she's like, yeah, of course I wanted to marry him or even give him kids, you know, I just – of course I'm now not quoting. She just wanted to be happy. She just wanted to get out of that lifestyle that Frank tries to put on her again. And it was kind of hard to watch because you're like, damn it, Frank, you're so bad.
Yeah. I think you're right. But I think like that's the scene in particular when she's, you know, kind of going off on that monologue about how, you know, I wouldn't mind giving him 6 kids and all this stuff. I wasn't sure then if the character was acting and just trying to like, you know, drum up goodwill for herself, or if that was like a legitimate, like a genuine feeling she was going through.
She stuck around till the very end, even with all those workers trying to get water from her. Like,
yeah.
If I wasn't down with that, I would have left a long time ago.
Yeah, and she was definitely like the hooker with the heart of gold character, I think.
So. Oh, such a hard stereotype.
Yeah. All right. Well, I mean, is there anything else you guys wanted to bring up?
I don't know. Did you see it on Blu-ray, on the new Blu-ray copy?
No, I actually – this is weird. I bought this movie on like 2-disc special edition DVD probably 5 or 6 years ago and never got around to watching it until whatever, 2 days ago. And now I feel like an idiot for not having seen it sooner because I liked it so much. But I think the runtime really was just what was kind of daunting to me. And you really have to like put yourself in the right mindset to be able to kind of handle any sort of movie that's over 2.5 hours. I think you have to kind of settle in and just prepare yourself as an audience member for that. And I just always it was a lot easier just to go to Netflix and watch something on instant or you know, just watch something that was disposable. And I didn't really have to commit to it. I was scared to make the commitment to this movie. And now I regret not having done it earlier. But
I highly recommend anybody who has a Blu-ray player to get this on Blu-ray, if only for the cinematography. I mean, you don't have to watch this movie in its entirety to appreciate it. Sometimes it's just such a damn good looking movie and the music is so great. But it looks really good on this Blu-ray. It's got the restored version and the theatrical version and a commentary that I don't know if this is on yours, but there was a commentary from – it includes 2 historians, 3 filmmakers that have – John Milius is in it and John Carpenter and I think somebody else. And then there's also Claudia Cardinale, I think, is also in there a little bit as a voiceover for the commentary. It's just damn good. If you need a Blu-ray, this is one of the Blu-rays. I wrote an article last year on Screen Rant, 10 movies that need a Blu-ray release. This was one of those 10, and it finally got on Blu-ray, and I'm so happy it did. It's a great release. And really, you know what? I can't say I disagree with anybody who doesn't like this movie because I understand why somebody wouldn't like it. You know, there's movies that I just don't get. Why the hell do you not like this movie? How can you not like it? But I get it with this. You have to know when you're going to watch it. You have to pick your time, and you have to be prepared for a super slow, drawn-out movie. But if you've got those 2.5 hours chalked out, it could be worth it.
Yeah, definitely. I agree. Tyler, any closing thoughts?
Yeah, if you're a fan of Westerns, like a real fan of Westerns, whether it be modern Westerns or John Wayne or the Spaghetti Westerns, yeah, it's definitely worth a watch. Again, like Mike was saying, you know, time it wisely because you are in for a slow wine, like slow, like the betterment of wine, if you will.
Nice.
You gotta let it settle. You can't be doing laundry or eating and talking with friends.
Yeah.
Because you'll lose your way, like I did.
Yeah, I think. You know, from an editing standpoint, it's fantastic. All the acting was great. Cinematography was really awesome. The direction was great. Like, every aspect of this movie from a technical standpoint was fantastic. And, yeah, it is definitely one of my favorite Westerns. So I would definitely recommend this to people. Although I will say, yeah, you probably should have a little bit of, you know, just a little bit of familiarity with the Western genre for it to mean as much to you as it was intended. You know, like, this movie is made for people who grew up with Westerns, because those were the movies that really came out in that time. You know, like, Westerns were so much more prevalent than they are today back then. So everybody who saw this movie in theaters had seen The Searchers and all of those movies, and that's not so much the case today. So go back, watch some of those old, you know, classic John Wayne films and some of Tyler's favorites, and then even, like, you know, some of the Dollars trilogy and some of the, you know, Leone's earlier stuff too, and then watch this movie, and I think you'll probably be pretty pleased with it if you're a fan, if you like what you saw up till that point, so.
And then watch Tombstone.
Yes, which obviously is one of Tyler and I's favorite films. Mike, have you seen Tombstone? I assume yes.
Yeah, I've seen it.
Do you like it? Yeah.
I'd say it's one of the top 5 or 10, probably one of the top 5 Westerns of all time.
There you go. That's what
top
I like
five.
To hear.
Yeah.
That's what I like to hear.
Who's coming with me?
If we could do a digital cowabunga high five right now, I would. But
we need to get a soundboard of just Tombstone lines for this.
Oh, man.
That would be sweet.
I'll be a huckleberry.
All right. Well, Tyler, you want to go ahead and rev up the Apple II and let people know what we're going to be watching next week?
Yeah, let's see. Oh, sticking with movies I guess you need to see, we're going to be watching Pulp Fiction.
Nice.
Tarantino, I think you may be familiar with him.
Yes.
John Travolta, Samuel L. Jackson, Uma Thurman, foot fetish, stuff like that.
Was this, Mike, was this from 1994 or was this 92?
94.
Okay, 94, there you go. Man. Coming in with your best year of movies ever of all time.
What other movies came out in 94?
Look up that year and tell me I'm wrong.
Was Ace Ventura 94?
Dumb and Dumber was. I think Ace Ventura
Dumb and
was.
Dumber, hell yeah.
I think Ace Ventura was 94 too. I think both of them came out in the same year. Just blanking. Yeah, they both came out in 94. Also The Mask. All three Jim Carrey movies in 94.
I'm just looking at the top grossing movies. I'm looking at Wikipedia, the top grossing movies of 94. Lion King, Forrest Gump, True Lies, The Mask, Speed, Clear and Present Danger. So yeah, I'm sure there's some awesome stuff in there.
Take a look at the Academy on 94. It's ridiculous. 1994 is a stupid year. I don't know what was going on, but everybody was making good movies. Like, there was Shawshank Redemption came out that year.
Oof. Man, that's
it's pretty good.
Yeah, totally. Good stuff. Yeah, I'll have to look into that because that sounds like an interesting theory that I don't know if I'll be able to prove incorrect based on what we just said. So
I think the only real evidence you need is that Blank Check came out in 1994.
Wow, really?
What a good movie.
Doesn't that make you feel old?
It does.
I remember a moment as a kid wanting to go to the video store because I thought Blank Check was there, but it hadn't been released on video yet.
Oh.
So that's how old I am.
Man.
Ugh.
Good stuff. Good times. All right, cool. Yeah, we're going to be watching Pulp Fiction. That's available on Netflix. Watch instantly, so feel free to check it out there. Watch along, and then send us an email. Let us know what you think. notjustnewmovies@gmail.com. Call and leave us a voicemail at 904-469-6566. Or check us out on Facebook. You know, you can leave us a comment there. Or Twitter at twitter.com/NJNMpodcast. We've actually got a few new followers this week. Jermaine Lucier, who is our guest last week from slashfilm.com, E. Douglas WW, who is Ed Douglas, who's a writer for ComingSoon.net, one of the best movie websites out there.
NotJustNewMovies.com.
Of course, yeah. That's a given. Broken underscore engineer is following us as well. Brian T. Merrill at P-U-J-A-S-A-B-N. Just not really anything that I can pronounce in like a normal word. Yes, it's Tyler's friend, I think. And then at Stacy Sirsua 71. So thanks for the follows there, guys. We appreciate it.
We just got a new follower too from at Eisentower 30.
Which would be our good friend Mike here. Awesome. So follow him. And you guys can also feel free to subscribe to this podcast for free in iTunes because – you know, why not? Leave us a comment, let us know, a little review or whatever. That actually helps out with our visibility and stuff on there. So if you have not left us a review on iTunes and if you've been listening for a while,
for shame,
do us a favor and just go over there and it takes 2 seconds, please. That would be great.
I review us daily.
I wish they would
great allow, podcast guys, you do a good job.
I wish they would allow that. All right, so Tyler, let's go ahead and wrap up the character name game. What was the character that we had for this week?
The character name for this character name game is Bruce Baxter.
Bruce Baxter. All right, Mike, do you have easy guesses as to what movie this character is from?
That's King Kong, Kyle Chandler.
Hell yeah.
That's awesome.
Right when you said that, I knew it was, for some reason that name was the most hilarious name, and he wasn't even really that – he was pretty funny in that movie, but his name was what really made me laugh.
Yeah, I think if I remember correctly, there was like a poster or something with him like swinging on a vine or something that, you know, just looked like really, really ridiculous. With
it was
his...
either that or... Oh, sorry.
No, go ahead.
I said it was either that or Elle Fanning's character in I Am Sam, and I don't really care for that movie, so I wasn't going to reference that.
Ooh, yeah, no, good call with Bruce Baxter. So, yeah, of course, the connection, Tyler, being...
He's in Super 8.
Yes, of course, yeah. You can find...
Bruce Baxter. The man.
I really hope he becomes a famous actor, though. I didn't know when he went on Friday Night Lights, the TV show. I was like, oh, he's a TV guy. I'm not really that into him now.
You know who he looks like is Jeff Bridges' brother, the dad from The Wizard.
Oh, Bridges?
Bo Bridges, yeah.
As the dad from The Wizard.
Yeah. I thought for a second it was him. I was like, man, he is ageless. He's playing a dad in this movie too. I'm like, that's not Bo Bridges.
Fred Savage's dad, and now these other kids. Yeah.
Hey, it would have been another nostalgia point.
Yep.
Remember that movie called The Wizard? There's nothing like that.
Which we talked about on an earlier episode of this podcast. So
check it out.
Check that out. Also, we talked about Lawrence of Arabia and The Fountain, which were both movies that we mentioned in this episode. So go back and check those out if you haven't heard them. Let's go around the circle real quick and wrap this up. Tell people where they can find more of your work on the internet. Mike Eisenberg, how about start with you?
Well, I do mostly video mashups and the Blu-ray DVD column on Screen Rant, screenrant.com. And I tweet like a mad hound on Twitter. And that's at Eisentower 30, E-I-S-E-N-T-O-W-E-R 30. And, well, that's about it. But, yeah, just stay tuned to my Twitter. I got some short films coming up that hopefully you guys will be interested in, and ones that I worked really hard on, and I hope that you guys like. And if you do, share them with the world and maybe have a whole podcast about it. Cause it's just...
Yeah, I was just about to say.
There we go. All right.
I can review them for you.
No,
I just reviewed Mike Lehan's.
Yes, Mrs.
Short
Pepperhorn's
film. So maybe
magical
I'll,
reading room.
I'll be the short film reviewer.
How much did I tip you for a good review?
I think I actually have to pay to write reviews at Ben's site.
You have
I
to
pay him.
You pay me, yeah.
You want the trailer on the DVD. Greatest movie nobody will ever see.
Oh, man. Awesome. All right. Well, Tyler, where can people track you down this week?
You can find me at the Solar Sentinel. Notjustnewmovies.com. Destageddon. I forgot about that site. And, yeah, I think I'm going to be having a little special interview in the coming week. So, yeah, a little cliffhanger there.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Good stuff.
Did you end up doing the interview with the Superman guy?
I have not done that yet. I'm supposed to be speaking to Drew McWeeny from HitFix.com.
Okay. Don't give too much away. It's for a surprise, but I guess you can say it.
Well, I already mentioned it last week, so.
It's Tom Welling, folks.
No, God, no. It's just one of the best, like, movie writers in the game. Movie news writers and film journalists, I guess. So
the movie, the game?
No, not the David Kirk Fincher Douglas? Film, the game. No, that's not Kirk Douglas. It's Michael Douglas.
Michael Douglas. All right.
Oh, that would be really interesting. But anyway, you guys can track me down this week on Twitter at twitter.com/BenPears. You can find me writing sporadically at geektyrant.com. My reviews are up at filmonic.com and notjustnewmovies.com, the namesake for this podcast. And you can hear me on the Geek Tyrant Weekly podcast as well. Music for this show is provided by George Turner and the Bandits. You can find their music at gtbandits.com. They're also on Twitter and Facebook, so check them out over there. Special thanks to Mike Eisenberg for stopping by and donating some of your time hanging out with us today.
What?
Yeah, cool. And like we said, we'll be watching Pulp Fiction next week, so check that out. Send us an email. Let us know what you think. And thanks for listening, everybody. We'll see you guys next week. Money that